Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Helen Chersky is a physicist and oceanographer who is fascinated by an ephemeral subject.
I study bubbles, and bubbles make a lot of sound underwater. And I actually study the sound that bubbles make in the ocean.
But no need to be in the water to hear some bubbles.
You actually hear them all the time. People don't think about it. But if you pour out a glass of water and you hear it go, bleh, 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 each little ping noise is a single bubble being formed. And so the bigger bubbles, it's like bells. The bigger bubbles ring with a deep note and the little bubbles ring with a high note. And so when you hear all those noises, bleh, 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 you're hearing the sizes of the bubbles that have been formed as the water was poured out. So I like sounds like that because there's a hidden message in them.
I never thought about it that way, that the sound of water being poured into a glass is really an orchestra of bubbles. Sound contains layers of information that go beyond what immediately hits the ear. Sound can bring so much joy. But it can also be a major source of irritation. It's a way to experience the world around us. Today's episode is all about sound and how we interact with it. Helen Chersky will be our tour guide of sorts, and we'll hear about creating sounds for a new world with changing technology and innovations. We'll meet people who create sounds for everything from incoming emails to electric cars. So Helen Chersky is an associate professor at University College London, and she thinks about sound a lot.
Sound is an interesting thing because it's a way of touching something that's a long way away in some senses. So you can only have sound if there's something for it to travel through. And for us, that's generally the air. So basically, if someone shoves on the air some distance away, then that air pushes on the air next to it, which pushes on the air next to that, and that sends a ripple of air. It's not the air itself that's moving, it's just shoving a bit. Each molecule shoves a bit on the one next to it. And eventually, that shove kind of makes its way into your ear, and that's what sound is. So it's a way of feeling a push from something a long way away.
Helen says our ears evolved to receive that shove.
They evolved underwater. So when we hear, we actually hear in water inside our inner ear. There are little hairs, and those little hairs are in a liquid. And so we actually listen inside a liquid. And so what our ear has to do, what our ears had to do when animals moved from the oceans into the air and had to evolve to detect sound on land, is they had to find a way to take sound that was in the air and shift it into sound that was in water, because that's how the inner ear detection works. And that's what your outer ear is for, your outer ear and your middle ear. So if you the thing that most people think of as your ear, which is the bit that sticks out the side of your head, that's a kind of funnel for sound. And all those little folds in it are actually, they're reflecting the sound in different ways. They affect the sound quality. And the sound will then find its way into your ear. And then there's a very clever structure with these three little bones that shifts it from being sound in air to being sound in water. And then that goes into your inner ear, and then you can hear. So our ears are really interesting, the translation mechanisms, actually. And something for your listeners to know that I did not know till somebody took molds of my ears for an experiment I was doing. Don't do this at home, but you can. I encourage you to take a picture of both your ears. They're not the same. If you look at the shape, your ears have all these shapes, these folds, and they are not the same in both your ears. And actually, they can be very different. And that is important to the way you hear. It helps you tell what direction sound is coming from. So actually, we shouldn't take hearing for granted. The fact that we have a sensor inside our head that is able to collect sound that's come from the outside world and interpret it, there's a whole load of very clever physical structures. And then, of course, we need our brain to interpret what that physical outcome means.
Now, you said our ears evolved in water, but I guess they have adapted so much to not being in water that now when we do hear something in water, it sounds really terrible or it sounds indiscernible.
It's very different. So, I mean, and you'll know anyone who's sort of put their head underwater at the swimming pool or the ocean, you are putting your head into a different world of sound. So that's the first thing, is that if you have a water surface, like the surface of a swimming pool, sound that's coming from above, from the air, and it hits that surface, it tends to reflect off and go back into the air. But there's also sound in the water. And if that comes up, you know, up to meet the surface, it tends to get reflected back down. So the sound, the world of sound above the water surface and below the water surface are almost completely separate. And then when we put our heads down into the water, of course, then our outer ear is not much use to us because it's the shape that works in air. So when we listen underwater, what we're actually doing is something closer to what the big fin whales do, the blue whale and the fin whale, the baleen whales. They hear through their jaw. So if you put your fingers up to the side of your jaw towards the back, you'll feel right there is a jawbone. Mm-hmm. And actually that's quite close to the air. So if you put your head underwater, that bone is quite close to the water. And so sound can travel from water into that bone quite easily, and it can then travel up to your ear on the inside. Now, it's not as effective, but it does work. So basically, when our heads are underwater, we're hearing more through our bones like the whales do than we are hearing like an air-breathing creature that's got ears designed for the air.
So hold on. This is all blowing my mind right now. So when I'm underwater, I'm touching my face right now, then the sound waves are hitting my jawbone, and then my jawbone is basically pushing that up to my ear. Is that how it works?
That's right, yeah. And some of that sound will come through your skull as well. There's actually a debate about which bits of the bone it comes through. Bone is nice and dense, so it's a similar-ish density to water, and that makes it easy for sound to go from the water directly into the bone. And actually, so sometimes you feel this if you... I'm trying to think of an example. So perhaps if you go to the dentist and the dentist, you know, puts a buzzing thing in your jaw, perhaps a drill or a cleaning device, something that buzzes, you'll sometimes feel that in the middle of your ear. Mm-hmm. And that's because if you follow your jawbone back all the way up to the top at the back, it almost pokes, not quite, but it almost pokes into your ear. It's quite a direct connection. So there's a very easy way for sound to be guided up into your ear. But you'll also hear a little bit through your skull, because obviously your skull is a big lump of bone, which is quite close. You know, sound can also travel from water into that bone. And so these bone conduction pathways can get sound into your ear. But as a result, you hear a bit differently, because they're much better at low frequencies, so the deep notes, than they are at the high frequencies. So when you put your head underwater, the sorts of things you hear are quite different. And it's partly because underwater sound is a bit different, but it's also because it's kind of filtered through your bone. And so that affects how you hear. It's quite a weird thought.
Of course, most of the time we're not listening underwater. We're on the surface just trying to make sense of the sounds bouncing back and forth all around us.
Actually, at the moment, I'm sitting at home talking to you, and that I've got a wooden floor and quite a hard ceiling. So some of what you're hearing is not just my voice that's coming from my mouth to the microphone, but you're also hearing a bit of sound that has bounced off my wooden desk and gone into the microphone, and bounced off the ceiling and gone into the microphone. And that gives it a slightly different quality of sound, all those little echoes.
Sometimes when Helen is doing research and trying to get to the essence of a sound without all of these echoes, she works in a space that's designed for that purpose.
There are things called anechoic chambers, which anechoic just means against echoes. You know, it's kind of anti-echo, if you like. And in those, what you see on the wall, and these are used for scientific experiments, and what you see on the walls are that they're kind of wedges of foam that are sticking out. And the sound can kind of bounce a little bit down the wedge towards the narrow bit, but it can never find its way back out. And they remove almost all echoes. And if you go into one of those rooms, it's really disconcerting. And you're actually hearing what your voice really sounds like without the environment, without sound bouncing off the environment around you, making it into a richer sound. I mean, I've spent quite a long time in those. I was once put in one for an hour to see if it made me upset in any way. And I loved it because I had a very busy life at the time and I thought the piece was great. But humans actually don't like being deprived of sound. So some people find that environment very distressing.
Can you describe what your voice sounded like to yourself?
So it's really strange. The closest I can come is that it just feels as though someone has sucked it away from you. It's you sound so thin, and it's like this little sound, and it feels like there's this big space which has just sucked it all away. And you're like, well, where's the rest of it? Your brain's kind of going, well, where, what, you know, there must be more. Where's that gone? So you can have a conversation in that room, and obviously you can hear the person you're speaking to very clearly because there's no other sound to get in the way. But if you're left in that environment by yourself, what happens is that your brain actually doesn't do very well with the complete absence of sound. And you see, so your brain will start to hear little noises. You might hear your own heartbeat, which you don't normally hear, but your brain becomes very sensitive. It's like it's desperate. There must be some sound out there. I must find some sound. So they are very strange environments. But of course, they're very, very useful for scientists, because if I have an experiment and I want to measure how much noise an engine is making, perhaps, or how, you know, how much noise an animal is making when it calls, if I put it in that environment and I make a recording, then I know that when my microphone is exactly 1 meter away, I know exactly how much sound is coming out. And so it's very, very useful if you want to do calculations of, you know, with the sound level, because it's absolutely uncontaminated by anything else.
I guess in our day-to-day lives, we end up tuning out most of the sound we hear. I'm thinking about all the sound that is going on all day long. I don't hear that, quote unquote.
Sensing is not just about the physical collection of a signal, if you like. You know, I can look, I've got a red notice board in front of me, and I can look at that and I'm seeing the color red. But actually, there's much more going on, because then your brain gets involved. And what we actually perceive is this combination of what our physical senses can detect in the outside world and then how our brain interprets them. And things get very interesting. And as you say, quite a lot of the time, without us being conscious of it, our brain is filtering things out. If there's a sound, you know, so perhaps there's a fan that you have on in your office every day, well, your brain will hear it for a bit, and then you'll just, your consciousness will stop noticing it. It doesn't need to know. It's been there a while. It's clearly not a threat. It's just a fan going in the background. And if someone reminds you, you go, oh, yes, I can hear a fan. But if you were to list the sounds you could hear without thinking about it, you know, you don't need to know the fan's there. It's been there a while. It's not doing anything bad. Your brain's just kind of gone, you don't need to know about that. Leave it alone. So we always have to be very careful that our brain is interpreting what we hear.
That's Helen Chersky. She is a physicist and oceanographer and the author of Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Helen was just talking about how we interpret sounds all day long. We can choose to ignore them or pay attention to them based on how important we think they are, or if they pose a threat. And that comes into play with our next story. Think about traffic noises. We can tune them out, hopefully, if we're away from the road and it's just the backdrop of modern living. But if you are in traffic, if you are biking, walking, or driving, you often have to pay attention to these noises to assess how close a vehicle is or where it's coming from. What we're hearing there is the internal combustion engine running. Electric cars, by comparison, are much quieter, and that's turning into a problem sound engineers are trying to solve. Alan Yu has more.
Angie Stout has been blind since birth. She lives in a suburb of Philadelphia, and sound is essential to how she navigates the world.
I can tell a septibus versus a truck versus, you know, a car. I can hear a diesel engine versus a gasoline engine. Sometimes if I know your car well, if I'm in your car a lot, I can even hear if it's a person's car that I know.
One time she was walking around in her neighborhood using her cane.
And I stepped out and I actually hit the car with my cane and realized it was moving, but very slowly. And it was the electric motor was on. I didn't actually know.
The driver did not stop. She immediately took a step back to the curb, and fortunately, she was okay. But she says electric cars that have no discernible engine sound are a problem.
My blind friends and I have definitely spoke about it, and it's a frustration for us.
She does not have much of a preference as to what the cars sound like, as long as the sound works as an effective warning system. That's certainly important for people who are blind, but it's important in other instances too. Sound is an early warning signal that a car is approaching. Many pedestrians are distracted, like people looking at their phones, for example. That is why government regulations say electric cars have to make a sound when they are moving. I asked Trevor Cox, a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford in the UK, to take a look at the ones for the US. He says, by and large, the law just says that the frequency range and volume of electric car sound have to be similar to those of a normal quiet gasoline or diesel car. But the law does not say what exactly the sound should be. That gives car manufacturers quite a bit of freedom. People who like cars have a lot of opinions about what a car should sound like.
Take Formula One, which was about 5 years ago, switched engines, went from those incredibly noisy engines down to the ones they do now, which are a bit quieter. And there were quite a lot of complaints from, you know, from the stalwarts who were used to hearing these incredibly loud engines when they went quiet.
To me, a car is just a transport device I use to cross highways and carry things I can't carry by hand. But it is a passion for people like Brianna Wu. She's the executive director of Rebellion Pack, which supports progressive candidates for political office. But more importantly for this story, she owns four Porsches.
In two of my Porsches, I do not even have modern stereos in them. Porsche engines famously have what we call a flat six engine in them, meaning there's no turbo or supercharger on it, and it's just this really thrilling guttural growl. So you're not just driving the car, you have this soundtrack from the engine going on right behind you.
She says she is rooting for electric cars to become mainstream. But the lack of that driving experience is part of the reason why she has not bought an electric car yet, not even the one from Porsche.
You also want the rumble, the feedback of it. If you're in a small, agile car, and you have an engine directly behind you, like I do in my mid-engine cars, you know, you can feel that engine when you're pushing 8,000, 9,000, you know, RPM. There's a visceralness to it.
So how can car makers satisfy Brianna and all the other drivers who care about what their cars sound like? I put that question to Stefan Gesell and Rudolf Hauptmeier, sound engineers at Audi.
I've been with Audi for maybe almost 20 years now, and the first 10 years, my job was to make cars more silent.
My boss asked me if I wanted to join with the sound development to make the cars more loud.
Stefan says he sees their job now as bridging the old world of gas-powered cars with the new world of electric cars.
Right now, we need something that is in between a conventional car and a spaceship to get all the people on board that are around. You know, the petrol heads as well as the electric vehicle fanboys.
It has to sound cool, but not draw too much attention. It has to be futuristic, without being annoying or boring. The car has to sound good while driving through the countryside or just down the street to a grocery store. For 6 years, Stefan and Rudolf and their colleagues tried all kinds of machine-like sounds, musical instruments, helicopters, cordless screwdrivers.
Such a job is not only done between 8 and 5, this is something that you take also with at home. And everything that you hear is something that could be relevant. And you learn to live with this. And from time to time you say, okay, I want to record this now.
They finally landed on a mix of 32 different sounds that included the sound of a fan and an electric guitar played with a violin bow. This is what they came up with for the Audi e-tron GT, a really expensive electric sports car. The sound comes from external speakers at the front and the back of the car and internal speakers by the passenger doors. Not every electric Audi will sound like that, because now the sound, just like any part of a car that can be designed, is a chance to say something about the car and the person driving it. That's why Renzo Vitali, creative director for sound experience at BMW Group, says his process starts with, what is the brand image of this car?
Mini, for instance. Mini is a brand that has a claim of being very, very young at heart, very, very passionate. But Mini is also an entity that it's always ready for a twist or as always a surprise.
He treats the engine sound like an art installation, something the driver can control by moving the pedals. He is a composer after all. This means that in the future, people walking past roads will not just hear similar kinds of engines over and over again, but a variety of different sounds mixing together. There is the potential of all the car makers coming up with different sounds that clash and sound bad when they're put together on a crowded street. But electric cars are by and large still quieter and have yet to become mainstream. And for Renzo, the diversity in sound makes the future more interesting than the present.
I like to mention John Cage, who once he was asked about the role of the sound of traffic in the cities, and he said, well, whenever I listen to the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, it's always the same. And for me, it's not that interesting. But whenever I open the window of my apartment on 6th Avenue and I hear the traffic, it's always different.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. Coming up, how the sounds of a lush rainforest inspired the pings and dings coming from your computer.
Intricate and immersive audio ecology that's really dense with information, but also very harmonious.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about sound and how we interact with it. The soundscape of our lives changes depending on where we are. And if you spend a lot of time working on a computer, tech sounds are usually part of your day. Incoming emails, calendar notifications, that file that didn't go through, they all have a distinct sound. Maybe those dings and pings sound somewhat simple to you, but for the people who create them, they are little works of art. Nicole Curry has this profile of a sound designer.
This is what Matthew Bennett considers the most beautiful sound in the world.
Intricate and immersive audio ecology that's really dense with information, but also very harmonious.
It's a rainforest in Papua New Guinea, one of the largest on the planet. It's home to many animals, tree kangaroos, yellow, black, and white frilled monarchs, forest wallabies, and countless insects. What Matthew loves the most about the rainforest is the different layers of sound.
There's foreground, background, there's the tree canopy, there's the insect layer, there's forest floor layer and all different kinds of leaves, and there's a little bit of wind blowing. For the amount of dense information that's coming at us, most people find those sounds beautiful and soothing.
As a sound designer, Matthew is best known for transforming Microsoft's soundscape, creating the classic email notification or event reminder sounds you may recall from Windows 8, 10, and 11. Remember this one? That's an incoming email. Or that one. That's that pesky event reminder. These sounds may seem simple or insignificant, But Matthew has dedicated his entire career to making them more pleasant, more beautiful. Matthew fell in love with sound design in the 90s. He was studying music composition at the University of Washington in Seattle. At the time, he was a jazz performer and dreamed of composing music until he heard about the Kaluli people. They live in Papua New Guinea, the same place with the rainforest that's home to Matthew's favorite sound.
I learned a lot about how the Kaluli people conceive of the sounds in their environment, in their rainforest environment, as part of their musical expression and the way they interact with those. Performers might do duets with a waterfall, or the sounds of birds are incorporated into many different music aspects of their rituals and other things.
Matthew felt inspired and decided to study sound design and engineering. In the same way the Kaluli people fused songs with their environment, Matthew now wanted to find a way to forge melodies with the sound of technology.
Around that time, I really started to think differently about the connection between music and what we usually think about as non-musical sound, and realized that there's really a continuum.
Matthew wanted to know more about other cultures and their relationship to sound. He left Seattle, traveling to Europe, West, and North Africa, carefully listening to beauty everywhere he stepped. This was all part of his PhD fieldwork. His most influential experience was in Morocco.
And the soundscape in rural and urban Morocco is just very different than the soundscapes in Europe.
While strolling through a day market, Matthew had heard the Adhan, the Islamic call to prayer, a sound he would listen to several more times that day.
Over the course of the day, that repetition, I think, just has a really beautiful resonance. And as I was living around that and really thinking about what it's like to live with that, it gives a certain texture to your life and a certain structure to it. In a way, it's like the monastic hours in Europe or the church bells ringing. It's not necessarily considered music in Islamic culture, but it can often be very beautiful.
The call to prayer really grabbed Matthew's attention. While followers of the religion were kneeling down to pray, he was instead noticing how the sound gave him a sense of peace, although it was alerting everyone to do something.
It can be aesthetically very beautiful, but it's also kind of about transcendence, I guess, and a relationship to the divine, and sound being used to create a relationship to the divine, which is very similar to the kinds of trance and chant that I was interested in these rituals in Morocco, where sound is used to organize the relationship to the sacred.
Matthew brought these experiences back to Washington. He started to experiment with computer-generated sounds and then eventually started working for Microsoft. Matthew wanted to merge technology with culture while interweaving the commonalities of everyone.
I worked with native speakers in many different languages, saying the kinds of things that the sound of the technology might be intended to communicate. There are ways to say, are you ready to go, in almost every language that has a very similar contour. Even if the speakers aren't necessarily saying literally, are you ready to go, they're saying something else culturally appropriate for that moment and that interaction. So by taking a whole lot of those statements and recording them and looking for parallels, I could distill down to some of those archetypes and use those to create sort of a new language for the system sounds.
Matthew doesn't work with Microsoft anymore, but he still creates sounds, always incorporating culture, beauty, and technology.
That story was reported by Nicole Curry. We're talking about sound and how we interact with it. Matthew Bennett traveled all over the world to find sounds that people enjoy and that are part of their culture. And this is something I also talked to physicist Helen Chersky about. There are sounds that are generally pleasing to us, others that are not. What makes the difference, or is that a more individual thing?
So some of it's cultural. Mm-hmm. Some things are learned, basically. If we learn to have a good association with a sound, we'll like it. You know, if you like bacon and you hear someone sizzling bacon in a pan, perhaps you'll like it. But I'm vegetarian. I don't like bacon, so I don't like sizzling. there's a little thing that's like that. But something we do tend to like is that our brains are quite good at the maths of this. So the sound that travels, it generally travels in waves, which means that there's a bit where the air molecules are squished closer to each other. And then if you go a little bit behind that, the air molecules are a bit more spaced out. And then behind that again, they're a bit closer together. So the sound is coming to you as a wave with sort of peaks and troughs. And the distance between the two peaks, that's the wavelength of sound. So the sound has a frequency, which is how often those peaks are arriving at your ear. And it's got a wavelength, which is the distance between one peak and the next one that comes along. Now, our brains really like mathematical relationships. So if you make a single sound, a pure tone, and then you also play at the same time one which is twice the frequency, exactly twice the frequency, that's what we call an octave. And our brain likes that because there's a harmonic relationship. There's a nice mathematical relationship between those two sounds. And it could also be the case, you know, within a single octave, you know, if someone plays a chord on the piano, the reason those four or five notes sound nice together is that they are all specific fractions of the longest wavelength. So there's a mathematical relationship. So quite often, it's the maths that we intuitively respond to. We like the harmonic relationship because those wavelengths have a specific ratio between them.
And I guess when a sound becomes too high-pitched, it doesn't feel good on the ear, and sometimes very low sounds also kind of feel weird.
So very low sounds, actually, they can go below what our ears can hear, but they might start to resonate with our bodies. Your internal organs actually have, there are certain frequencies that they respond very strongly to, and those are low frequencies, much lower than we can hear. And if you hear that sort of sound, you'll feel it on the inside because it's so low that the vibration is happening so slowly that your insides can actually vibrate at the same rate, and that feels a bit weird. So if you're somewhere where there's a really, you know, you can feel sound coming through the floor, like the floor's vibrating, and it's a really low, deep sound.
When somebody drives by with a car and they have the bass and it's like... Yeah.
So you really are feeling that on the inside because your insides can detect vibration. They're just not really set up for it.
Helen Chersky is a physicist and associate professor at University College. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find our show wherever you get your podcasts. Helen was just talking about sounds we like and sounds we don't like. And many people don't like the sound of their own voice when they hear a recording of it. Somehow your own voice sounds weird to you. Different. And you wonder, this is what I sound like? But when you ask people about it, they'll probably say, sure, yeah, this sounds like you.
The first time I heard myself on the radio, I thought I would be ill.
That's Terry Gross, you know, the host of Fresh Air.
It sounded so different than I thought I sounded. And it's not even that it was like better or worse. It was just so different. It was so disorienting. But at this point, I'm so used to hearing myself on tape and hearing myself in the real world that the difference between the two doesn't sound extreme to me anymore.
And when you first heard yourself, what was it different? How? You said it was shocking, but how? So,
I think my voice sounded higher to me than I thought. I realized I talk really quickly. I still haven't solved that problem yet.
Did you ever have the thing where you hear yourself and you think, was that me or was that some, who's that?
Well, occasionally I'll hear myself. So to be honest, we have a speaker in the ladies' room. So HYY is always on in the ladies' room. So sometimes I'll walk in and I'll think, who's that? And I'll realize it's me. And other times I'll walk in and I'll think, oh, somebody's playing my tape. And I'll realize it's not me. But that's only for like the first couple of seconds. And then I realize who it actually is.
I always joke that at our work, we don't have driveway moments, we have bathroom moments.
Yes, that's right.
That's the only time we get to listen to the radio. Terry, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
So why does our own voice sound strange to us when we hear it in a recording? I asked William Hartman. He is part of the psychoacoustics group at Michigan State University. He says, here's what's happening when you listen to yourself as you talk.
The acoustical difference is primarily a boost in the low frequencies that you get when you listen to yourself. And other people don't get that. So the microphone that records you doesn't get that either. That's the difference.
And he told me that the boost of the low frequencies happens because of how sound travels inside of our bodies.
When you hear yourself, there's not only the acoustical pathway, but there's also the pathway through your own body, principally through the bones of your head. The acoustical pathway goes through your outer ear, your middle ear, and your inner ear in the way that sound normally does. The bone conduction pathway goes immediately to your inner ear. It vibrates the fluids of your inner ear. And that pathway does tend to emphasize lower frequencies, particularly the fundamental frequency of your voice.
So that's why our voices sound deeper to us in our heads and higher in recordings. William Hartman is a professor of physics at Michigan State University. Coming up, when the sound all around us gets to be too much to handle.
That's a street corner where, you know, there's a subway station underneath it, and for whatever reason, the screeching of the brakes is particularly bad on that corner. So you will just cross the street before you get to that junction, and you'll go up to the next street and you'll walk along.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about sound and how we interact with it. Sometimes it can be hard to tell where sound is coming from. I remember one time my family was on this little vacation and my uncle lost his wristwatch. It was a digital watch and every hour it would make a beep, like beep, beep, beep. So we heard the beep in the hotel room, and we knew the watch was there, but we couldn't figure out where the beep was coming from. So every hour, all of us would pile into this room and wait for the beep, and then try to figure out where's the watch. And it took us several tries to figure out that it had gotten stuck between the mattress and the bed frame. So locating sound can be a real challenge, and I asked physicist Helen Chersky about that.
You know, having two ears is really useful because they're in different places. And what that means is that, so if you imagine standing in the middle of a clock face, for example, a big clock face, and you've got, you're looking around you, there's a person at 10 o'clock and a person at 12 o'clock who's facing you, and there's a person at 2 o'clock. If each of those people made a noise, so the one who is slightly to your right, let's say at 2 o'clock, that sound will reach your right ear a little bit before it reaches your left ear. And so your brain can detect that difference and it says, oh, that it must have sound must have come from that direction. And then if it's the person who's at 10 o'clock to your left, that sound will reach your left ear before your right ear. The way your brain picks that up is the timing difference. The sound arrives at one a bit before the other. And you would then say, well, how does that help with things that are higher or lower? Because if it's up in front, if it's at 12 o'clock, but it's high up or low down, well, that sound is going to arrive at both my ears at the same time. Well, that's where those wiggles in your ear come in. And if sound comes to one ear and then the other ear, it bounces off those wiggles, the sort of folds in your ear, and it takes a different amount of time and it sounds a bit different depending on where it came from, whether it came from high up or low down. So the shape of your ear actually helps you distinguish whether things have come from high up or low down.
But there are situations where figuring out where a sound is coming from becomes more difficult.
The thing that makes us really bad at it is hearing underwater. You know, if you're swimming in the sea, perhaps, and you hear the sound of a boat, it's almost impossible to tell where the boat is relative to you. And the reason for that is that sound travels much faster in water. And so because it travels faster, there's a much smaller time gap between left and right. And so your brain sort of feels, well, the sound arrived everywhere all at once. I don't have any idea. It got here so quickly, you know, I can't distinguish. And so we're not bad, most of us are not bad in the air at distinguishing direction, but we're very bad underwater. The times up in the air when we are pretty bad at it is when there's lots of surfaces for it to reflect from. And if you're standing in front of a big cliff, for example, that's reflecting sound back from behind you, you then might find it hard to distinguish where the sound is getting to you. Or, you know, imagine you're standing next to lots of buildings with corners and hard walls, and there's a sound that's a few streets away. Well, it could bounce off a lot of different walls to get to you. And so the signals don't really make sense because they've all taken different paths and your brain can't really make any sense of that. So that's a situation in which we're not quite as good at telling what direction the sound comes from.
Helen Chersky is a physicist and oceanographer. Her book is Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Helen was just talking about how our environment can impact how we hear sound. But not everyone processes sound in the same way. Our next story is about a disorder where everyday noises become unbearable. Dan Latou has more.
Jared Calkin lives with a hearing condition called hyperacusis. It's rare, and it makes him really sensitive to noise. Everyday sounds become painfully loud. If Jared walks by a dog barking, it feels like a siren blasting in his ear. He has to plan his life around noise.
During the first few years, I wouldn't go somewhere to meet someone if I hadn't been there before and knew what the noise level was like.
Jared lives in New York City, and getting around looks a little different. He wears earplugs, protecting his hearing from sounds that you and I might brush off. Let's say you need to walk a few blocks up the street. You would most likely just walk a straight line, but Jared sees the map differently.
That's a street corner where, you know, there's a subway station underneath it, and for whatever reason, the screeching of the brakes is particularly bad on that corner. So you will just cross the street before you get to that junction, and you'll go up to the next street and you'll walk along.
Instead of walking in a straight line, Jared is zigzagging.
Or if there are, you know, if there's like an outdoor restaurant with a bunch of, you know, that there are drunk people outside that bar always making a lot of noise, you just walk around the block to make sure that you can kind of skip that whole experience.
Of course, some loud noises just sneak up on him.
Garbage trucks or, of course, sirens, everyone's favorite. And in those moments, you just stop and, you know, with your in-ear devices on or your headphones, your hands are over your ears, or you try and get off the street or like speed up walking or run to kind of change your sound environment.
Noise controls Jared's entire schedule. He works at a product launch agency and used to get to the office early just to have 2 hours of quiet before anyone else arrived. He'd leave early to beat the sounds of rush hour. He'd run 10 miles at the gym before dawn just to exhaust himself enough to sleep through noises at night. But in March 2020, during the early days of the pandemic, the streets were no longer the enemy.
So interesting to see the city change, you know, overnight, kind of, and have the totally different auditory map for the city. And being able to go outside and kind of cautiously experience New York in a very, very different way.
Many people noticed the absence of noise during the beginning of the pandemic. And maybe it was a bit of a wake-up call in terms of how loud life can be most of the time. We're not all going to develop Jared sensitivity, but he's tuned in to just how dangerous noise can be. On average, 1 in 8 Americans will lose their hearing in both ears.
There is huge chunks of our population that don't even recognize noise exposure as an issue at all.
This is Lauren Smith. She's a public health researcher at the University of Michigan who studies sound.
It's just an expected exposure that we go through life with, and there's nothing you can really do about it. And I don't think they really recognize the long-term effects.
She's working on the Apple Hearing Study, a partnership with the tech giant since 2019. Through iPhones and Apple Watches, they've been collecting data about noise environments for thousands of participants across the country. When the pandemic began, Lauren and her team noticed something.
Across all states, however, we saw that March 13th and March 14th were the day in which noise levels dropped pretty significantly.
It was unheard of. A nationwide drop in the average sound environment.
On average, if you look at the post drop compared to the baseline period, we saw about a 3 decibel reduction in noise.
3 decibels is actually a pretty big deal. The Environmental Protection Agency puts the safe level of sound at 70 decibels, and this drop brought participants closer to that threshold. 70 decibels is a loud dishwasher. But average city traffic, 80 decibels. A subway braking, a motorcycle engine revving, that's 90 decibels. The headphone volume on an iPhone at full blast, 100 decibels. Our hearing depends on hair cells inside our ears. Exposure over and over again to high decibel sounds will cause those hair cells to literally die. Sounds at 90 decibels can cause permanent damage after 2 hours. For 100 decibels, it's just 15 minutes. Anything above 120 decibels, like jackhammers and loud sirens, can cause immediate damage. Sound and hearing experts often call this noise pollution. And Lauren says it can have broad impacts on health.
Beyond hearing loss, recent studies have started to associate noise exposure with other detrimental health outcomes like cardiovascular disease and hypertension.
It's an issue that advocates have been raising the alarm about for years. Monica Hammer is an environmental public health lawyer. She began advocating for noise pollution policy as a legislative aide to the Chicago City Council.
You know, just like people didn't care about water pollution until a river was on fire. People didn't care about air pollution until you couldn't see the sky in LA. You know, we're just kind of reaching that threshold with noise.
Monica sees a number of solutions. At the federal level, noise could be included on more environmental impact statements, essentially treating noise pollution like other pollutions. At a city level, garbage trucks could be retrofitted to be quieter, and sirens could be designed to still alert people, but at safer decibels. So rather than accepting our loud lives in full swing, there might be a lesson from those quieter days of the pandemic. When we notice the everyday noises around us, maybe we should question how loud they should be.
That story was reported by Dan Latou. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we're going to continue our exploration of sound and we'll focus in on noise. We'll meet a noise detective who is trying to make people's lives quieter and hear about a shrill beeping sound that was driving an entire neighborhood crazy and nobody could figure out what it was.
It was really chipping away at my sanity because I wasn't sleeping and I would like put a pillow around my head and I could still hear it. I just still had no idea where it was coming from.
We'll also find out about an effort to reduce alarms in hospitals.
For a cardiovascular alarm, we've embedded a lub-dub sound like a beating heart. So when you hear an alarm and you hear that lub-dub, you know it's a cardiovascular problem.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Grant Hill. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.